Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast, episode number 120, interview with Frank King. I am your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Remember to subscribe to my podcast so that you can receive alerts when new episodes are available each week on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I ask that you support my podcast by pledging monthly or your one-time donation. Also, don't forget to share your favorite episodes. Please leave me a 5-star review on iTunes. Follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter, Maurice Flournoy, and Facebook, New Mind Creator. Frank King is known as the mental health comedian. He's a former writer on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno for 20 years. He's a 4-time TEDx speaker and a master's level bodybuilder for 60-year-olds and up. So Frank, where have you been in the last 10 days or so? What cities or towns have you been in?
Okay, let's see. We live in Eugene. I drove up to Portland because Eugene kind of a small airport. Southwest doesn't fly there. I took a flight from Portland to Denver. Drove 3.5 hours to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. I did a keynote and a breakout at a big mental health fair. That afternoon, I drove 6.5 hours to Durango, Colorado for dress rehearsal for my 5th TEDx. The next day, I did my 5th TEDx, which is also on mental health. It's called Mental Health and the Orgasm, Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly, and a little lighter fare than my previous 4. And I got my first TEDx standing ovation, by the way, he said, bragging. And then I drove that afternoon, drove 6.5 hours back to Denver because I had to get to Seattle. I did 3 evenings in Seattle, 3-hour trainings each evening for suicide prevention as a dental practice health and safety issue. And then I flew home from Seattle. I was home 8 hours, got back in a rental car, drove back up to Portland. And I flew to, wait a minute. And I flew to, where did I fly to? Oh, I flew to Manchester yesterday. Drove up, down, I can't, East Coast, you know, anything above Virginia, I can't really figure out because, you know, it's the North, it's the Yankees. I drove to Bangor, Maine, where I am right this minute, and I'm doing a fundraiser, entertaining only at a fundraiser for the YMCA. Actually, they wanted me to do a little bit of mental health comedian up. They chose me over other comedians because the YMCA has a big push on mental health. So I'll do a little bit on mental health, and then I'll do my straight stand-up. And then at 1 o'clock this morning, I'll drive back to Manchester, fly to Louisville, Kentucky. On Monday, I'll film a 3-hour webinar version of the thing I did in Seattle for 3 nights. And then I'll fly home on Tuesday, home Wednesday. And then I'll fly to Ho Chi Minh City on Thursday to join a cruise ship. I do cruise comedy on Holland America. And we'll sail 7 days. I'll get off in Singapore, fly home. And then next month, I'll fly from, I guess, probably Seattle to Tahiti, sail 2 weeks back to San Diego, fly home. That's pretty much where I've been and where I'll be the rest of the year.
Wow. How on earth do you maintain this schedule? Because it seems like a really busy schedule.
Yeah, well, it's. I was walking through an airport dead tired the other day thinking, you know, if I didn't eat right, get a good night's sleep, and work out like a Trojan, I wouldn't be able to keep this schedule at 63 years old. So I, in the mental health business, they call it a self-care plan. You know, you have to look after yourself mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. And I diet, exercise, try to get a good night's sleep, medication, meditation, and I'm doing what I love for a living. And people always ask me, do you like doing speaking? Do you like doing comedy? You'd have to love it. Otherwise you wouldn't do it because between the travel and the marketing and the booking, you know, the fun part is when you get up on stage, that your job is pretty much done at that point. It's just all the stuff in between. Like when I fly to Ho Chi Minh City and get on the ship, I'll tell the passengers at my show, okay, look, the jokes are free. You guys paid me to get here because that's like 12 hours in coach, which is not, you know, no day at the beach. So yeah, it's a rigorous schedule. But again, I, you know, I got up this morning early. I went in, I got on the elliptical runner and, you know, and I'm on the keto diet and do alternative day fasting because at 63, you know, I mean, if I was 23, I wouldn't worry about it. I'd get drunk every night, but I'm 63. And although there are comics who do that, I don't know how they manage it, but I can't do that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about your diet. So you do intermittent fasting?
Yeah, there's a very popular, most popular hours for that are you fast for 18 hours, eat for 6. And although I do that when I'm on the road, when I'm home, I only eat between 10 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, then fast for about 20, 22 hours. The next day, I eat between 10 and 2. I drop my weight about 35 pounds and drop my body fat from 18 to 8% where it sits right now.
And when did you start this eating regimen? How long have you been doing it?
That was January 1st, 2018, because being a bodybuilder was on my bucket list. And I waited until I was at least 60, because at 60, you slip into the master's class or master's category, and pretty much everybody else has given up. So the competition's a lot less fierce at that age. Plus, at that age, it's not so much about being big as it is muscularity, vascularity, and proportion. So you don't have to be huge, because I'm fine boned, as my mother would say. I'm fine boned, ectomorph, and so it's almost like body sculpting more than body building. You know, you want to make sure when you get up there that you look like somebody carved you out of clay. You know, you can see all the, you know, you see both of the bicep muscles, all three of the tricep muscles, like that. So the terrifying part was, in the morning, I don't know if you've ever seen a bodybuilding contest, but in the morning, there's the judging. You go out and you do the mandatory poses. In the evening, it's really just a show for the audience. So, and you have to do a 1-minute routine, kind of like dancing almost. You know, you go out, you move, you pose, you move, you pose for a minute to music. And essentially in your underwear in front of 300 people, which was terrifying. I opened up for Randy Travis for 2 nights in Michigan at an amphitheater years ago in front of 5,000 people each night. Didn't break a sweat. I had flop sweat going out in my underwear to pose in front of 300 people. So it's a whole different dynamic.
Wow. That's commendable. I've seen all of your, TEDx talks, and you look pretty fit. And I was like, wow. 'Cause I know being on the road, you have to be so structured in order to, that's what I was thinking, to be able to maintain, because it's so easy to being away from home, out of your comfort zone, to begin eating things that you wouldn't normally eat.
Yeah, that's where the keto diet comes in. The keto diet, you know, very, very, very low in carbohydrates, mostly just fat and protein. And, you know, I carry bars in my bag because when I've had heart problems my entire life, thanks to my family. My dad had a bad heart valve. I inherited it. And then my mom had the cholesterol of a deep fat fryer, got that. And so I've had 2 aortic valve replacements, a double bypass, a heart attack, and 3 stents. So I was already in the gym anyway for that, for cardio. And then I thought, you know, might as well have a goal while I'm here at the gym. And then I found keto at January of 18. And I can carry, you know, Atkins bars or low carb bars from Costco in my bag, so I'm not tempted between meals to go to McDonald's, although I'd love to have a Filet-O-Fish covered in tartar sauce, but that's another story. And, you know, they say, Maurice, that OCD, they say it like a bad thing. But I've got a little touch of that. So I just put that to use by, you know, I pretty much eat the same thing every day, day after day after day. People marvel at that. And I, you know, that's just a little touch of, I believe you can put your mental illness to use. That's one I've been able to put to use is to maintain that diet day after day after day. And after you give up white sugar, by the way, at least for me, after I gave up white sugar, white flour, I think years ago I had a piece of cake or something, and I got so sick and threw up, and I was hungover like I'd been drinking all day. I think your body loses the ability to process white sugar, white flour after a while. So now I'm at the point where I can eat it. I just have to, you know, avoid processed foods.
Yeah, the foods that we have been, that's so readily available to us, is not necessarily natural. So we can.
And you know, Taco Bell's got that fourth meal of the day. Humans were not designed to eat 4 meals a day. Matter of fact, there's a book called Eat, Stop, Eat on fasting, because I want to make sure that I did it in a healthy way. So I bought the complete book of fasting. And in that book, they mentioned Eat, Stop, Eat, another book. And they said in there that humans aren't designed really to have breakfast. Because it's just something that the food companies have, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. They've convinced us of that. And you know, the term feast or famine didn't come out of nowhere. Back in the day, back in the time of cavemen or whatever, they would feast. I mean, they would eat when there was something to eat, and they would fast when there was nothing to eat. And so that's kind of how we're designed. I think that's why the alternative day fasting works, is because that's kind of how the human body is designed.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I know I stopped eating breakfast maybe at least 8 to 10 years now. And yeah, and I feel just fine. I don't feel hungry or anything. So yeah, you're right. We aren't designed to just be packing food in our mouths all day. So
yeah, and you know, if I have a big lunch, which I do, I have a big lunch, big midday meal between 10 and 2. And then I go to bed early at night. So, you know, I go to bed by 7 o'clock at night. I'm a morning person. So then, you know, you're fasting overnight. That's 8 hours of your fasting. And then I get up in the morning, and you can have a cup of coffee. You can have cream or MCT oil in it. So I have a cup of coffee, and then I don't eat again until 10 in the morning. And granted, I'm a little hungry by 10 o'clock, but, you know, I'm not starving. I'm not, you know, just, you know, ravenous. So it's, it just, you know, and different diets work for different people. But as I said to my partner at the gym, my superpower is I have the ability not to eat. But I think they've been feeding me to hold me back.
That is a good one.
Well, he would tell you I'm stronger when I haven't had anything to eat for like 20 hours.
Wow.
But yeah, it's something, I don't know why. And like I said, it's my superpower. I think they've been keeping me down all these years by feeding me.
Yeah, blame your mom, right? So
yes, exactly.
When you were a kid, did you always have this sense of humor that you have?
Oh, yeah. Family's funny. My mom's funny. My sister's funny. My dad died at 40 when I was 8. So I know he had a good sense of humor. I don't know if he's as funny as my mom or my sister. And I told my first joke in fourth grade, and all the kids in the class laughed. And I thought, oh, man, I'm going to be a comedian. So I've wanted to be a comedian since fourth grade. Then I did the high school talent show my senior year. Nobody had ever done stand-up before. I was the first person ever to do stand-up at the talent show, and I won. And I told my mother I was going to be a comedian, and she said, because education is very important to her family, son, you going to college. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care, but you, son, are going to be a goat herder with a degree. So I went to Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill, and got a couple of degrees, and then moved to the West Coast, started selling insurance because that's what my first wife wanted me to do. Started going to open mic night. That was the beginning of the end of the insurance career right there. First night on stage, in my head, I heard, I'm home. I'm going to do this for a living. I don't know how, but I'm going to do it. So, and then another year later, I got 10 weeks booked on the road. It was really good timing, Maurice, because we're right there, kind of at the first quarter of the big comedy club boom. And so I booked 10 weeks on the road, said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 32 years, I said, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian. You want to come along? And inexplicably, she said yes. So we put everything into storage we couldn't fit into my tiny little Dodge Colt, quit our jobs, gave up the apartment, and hit the road. And she and I were on the road. She just came along for the ride for 2,629 nights in a row, roughly 7 years and change. And we opened up, and I worked with Seinfeld and Dennis Miller and Ellen DeGeneres and Rosie and Adam Sandler and Kevin James and, you know, all, just back when they were just comics. working the comedy club circuit. So it was an amazing 7 years traveling around the country working with those people.
Yeah, that's interesting that you've come into contact with a lot of other well-known people, comedians as yourself. But is there anyone that really, people that you've come into contact with, you've been like in awe of their rise to fame?
Seinfeld's work ethic, you know, because Maurice, I've said this many times, comedians don't become comedians because they have an amazing work ethic. you know, you're working 45 minutes a night. I mean, there's no easier job, I don't think. But Seinfeld, I worked with him 1 week in Raleigh at the club there, Charlie Goodnight's. And we did seven shows, I think, and he did seven different 45-minute sets, completely different, which is just an amazing amount of material. He was a workhorse. There's a joke among comedians. You know, if you go to the grocery store with Seinfeld, You get a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, he gets 3 minutes of material.
Mm.
So he was Leno, also an amazing work ethic and a really nice guy, and remembers where he came from. And when the Tonight Show ended and we were going to part company, I said to him, you know, I'd love a little demo video or, you know, video testimonial that I could put on my corporate reel. And he said, yeah, you know, I'm going to be doing a show with CNBC. They really don't like me doing a video. But, you know, I tell you what, if you ever get another shot at like a morning show on the radio or something, you know, and it comes down like you and one other guy, call Helga, my assistant, and give him the radio person's phone number, name, and I'll call him up and see if I can't strong arm him into giving you the job. So I got that in my pocket, Maurice. I'm waiting for the opportunity. Some big opportunity where it comes down to me and somebody else, and I get Leonard to call and hammer on him.
Yeah, that would be amazing. He does that. Definitely comes across. I've seen, you know, the Tonight Show and just how he interacts with people. I can see the sensitivity that he has as well. So,
yeah, he's just a genuinely nice guy. Does things like that. I mean, that would never benefit him in any way, but it would be a huge thing for me. There was a kid he worked with. I can't think of the guy's name. Anyway, years ago, Leno bumped into him at the Improv in Hollywood. And Leno apparently has a prodigious memory. And he recognized the guy right off, and he called him by name. And the kid said to him, hey, Jay, you know, we worked together 10 years ago at the, you know, at the Funny Bone in Kansas City. My folks came to the show, and it's their 35th or 50th anniversary or whatever. And Jay goes, give me the name. Give me the names again. Give me the number. So the next morning, the comic gets up and the phone's ringing. It's his mom. And she goes, you're never going to believe who called and wished your dad and me a happy anniversary. I mean, you know, just nice things out of the blue. You know, they didn't not to benefit himself in any way. Just made the comedian's day, made his parents' day. That's just the kind of guy he is. I think he likes to do that because he can.
True. And so, Frank, how on earth did you become a writer on the Tonight Show for 20 years? How did that opportunity come about?
Well, I'm a big networker. My mother was a networker. I didn't know she was doing it when she was doing it. Phone would ring at our house all hours, day and night, with people calling up and asking her if she could do, you know, Dixie was her name, asking, you know, could she help with something? And she really enjoyed, kind of like Leno, she would do it because she could. And so I learned that part of networking, you know, give value first without expectation of return from my mother. And I didn't know that everybody wasn't trained that way until I was at Barnes & Noble and I saw my first book, like Networking for Dummies. I thought, people don't know how to do this. They're not hardwired for this. So because I was on the road and I was networking and I was doing favors for people, I did a favor for somebody. The guy said, look, I've been writing, you know, jokes for Leno by fax, because Leno was the permanent guest host at that time. And what would happen is Johnny Carson, who was very mercurial, would say on a Friday night to his staff, hey, I'm taking next week off, out of the blue. I'm taking next week off. Monday nights back in the day was a Best of Carson rerun. And then Jay would have to cover four nights, Tuesday through Friday. And each night there's like 15 to 18 jokes in the monologue. So here's Leno on Friday evening, knowing he's got to come up with four nights of 18 jokes a night. So I guess he started talking to his comedian buddies, having them sign, you know, independent contractor paperwork. And the kid I bumped into, now not a kid anymore, was doing it. And he goes, yeah, here's the woman you called. They'll send you the paperwork, sign up as an independent contractor, start submitting jokes because they give you a fax number back in the day. And every now and then, They had lots and lots of people doing this, lots of comics doing it. But every now and then they would change the fax number to separate the wheat from the chaff. And I kept getting the new fax number. And then when he took over the Tonight Show for real, I got the new fax number. So he kept some of us on in that position. And I had two jokes on his very first show when he took over for Johnny. So,
wow, that's an amazing story.
My networking prowess. Thank you, Mama.
Yeah. So I believe, you know, that comes natural to you and your mom modeled it for you. And I think sometimes people are fearful. Meaning they give something, they want an immediate return sometimes, or they think that there's not enough, because it seems like you come from the perspective of I'm just going to give this out. And at some point, something is going to happen for me because there's plenty, you know?
Yeah. And I hope people will return the favor. Most people don't, but some people do. The reason I'm working cruises is a friend of mine called. He said, look, I've got this woman friend. She's playing clubs. It's awful. She's good, but the clubs are awful, especially for women, because you're traveling alone. She wants to do corporate comedy. You're doing corporate comedy. Would you help her out? Sure. So I talked to her and I got her started in corporate comedy. That was probably 2002 or three. And then fast forward to the recession. And I said to her, because we became friends, I think I'm going to have to go back selling insurance because, you know, we're losing everything in a bankruptcy. And my speaking work's dropped off 80%. She goes, you're not going to sell insurance. My cruise agent has a showcase next Friday. I know for a fact somebody just dropped out. She's got one spot left. You have to fly yourself there and bring yourself home. But if you want it, I can get it for you. So I got that spot to audition for the cruise talent coordinators who came to Atlanta to see everybody. And I've been working on Holland America. It'll be 10 years this spring. And that saved us financially. That got us through, you know, the end of our previous life and the beginning of the bankruptcy. If it hadn't been for the cruises, I don't know what we would have done. So, so she returned the favor, but not everybody does. The best thing I've ever done for anybody, and if I never do something nice for anybody again, this will get me into heaven if there is such a place. A friend of mine in a martial arts class came in one morning. It was Monday, and she was crying. I said, Elise, why are you crying? She goes, well, my husband's in Nepal. We're trying to adopt a 3-year-old. He's been there several times. He's on his last visa. He's got 7 days left on the visa. If we don't make it happen in the next week, it's not going to happen. And I said, well, why, what's the holdup of the 3-year-old? She goes, well, the birth mother, birth father, everybody, the government of Nepal signed off. Homeland Security is holding it back. And I said, well, I've never had a 3-year-old, but I don't believe they're that big a terrorist, unless I'm wrong. And my mother, who was then deceased, I channeled her, I guess, because I said exactly what she would have said. I said to Elise, I'll see what I can do. And then my next thought was, did I just say that out loud? Because I'm a comedian. I was living on Whidbey Island in the Puget Sound, off the coast of Washington. And we're talking about international politics in Nepal, all the way around the other side of the world. And what could I possibly do? But I believe that if you give voice to something like that, it takes upon a life of its own. And so I'm driving home thinking, oh God, what have I done? And then it hit me. There's a guy that I was in junior high school with who became mayor of Raleigh and then went to work for a heinous senator named Strom Thurmond, a big time Republican, and was in the Senate. He was like an aide de camp to Strom Thurmond. But I've kept up with Tom all that time because my wife will tell you I collect people and I connect people because networking, it's like a garden. You've got to tend it. Anyway, the problem for Elise was she's a big time Democrat, state of Washington. Everybody there's a Democrat, both senators are Democrat. And this is right smack in the middle of the Bush administration. And everybody in power in Washington at this point is a Republican. So I'm thinking to myself, I need a Republican who cares about kids. And then I thought of Tom Fetzer. That's the former junior high school pal, then mayor, then Senate aide. So I called up Tom on Tuesday, got hold of him. And I gave him the story. And he said, bless his heart, same thing my mother would say, I'll see what I can do. So on Wednesday, he called Elizabeth Dole, who happened to be senator from North Carolina at the time. Tom knew her from his time as an aide. And Elizabeth Dole called Homeland Security on Thursday. Tom called me back on Friday. And I said, well, what happened, Tom? He goes, well, I told Elizabeth Dole. She called Homeland Security. I said, what happened? And he said, well, she tore him a new a-hole, apparently. So the paper went, got faxed or whatever to the embassy in Nepal on Saturday, which, of course, was Sunday there. And then on Sunday there, Monday in Nepal, last day of the visa, they signed off on the 3-year-old to leave the country. And course, now on Monday, I'm in martial arts class, no Elise. Tuesday, no Elise. And I'm thinking, oh, man, it didn't work. So I go to the grocery store after a martial arts class. I push my little buggy. I come around the corner, and there stands Elise. And she's holding the hand of this darling three-year-old. Now, if she's crying, I'm crying. And she goes, this is, and I said, I would recognize him anywhere. And he looked up at me, 3 years old, his name's Avi. He looked up at me, and he said this, Avi, go pee-pee. I said, yes, and on American soil. So if I never do anything nice for anybody again, ever, I think my account is paid in full.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story for it to.
And when I do it as a networking speech, the networking speech is called WWDD, What Would Dixie Do? So at the end, after I, you know, do the on American soil, I said, what I'd like you to do is I would like to encourage you to, you know, do the same, because that's what Dixie would do.
Yeah, that's definitely a selfless act when we help others, just because they need the help, and it's within our power to do things. So that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's something I learned at her knee, and I help people all the time now with comics and speakers and whatever. At the end, sometimes they go, "I'll pay you commission." I go, "No, that's not the way it works." I tell them, "I'm like the mafia, you know, the mob. I'll do a favor for you. Someday I will come to you for a kindness, and you will grant me this kindness." Yeah, I just tell them, look, let's say you get a sitcom. My dream, the only thing that on my bucket list, job-wise, that I've never done that I would kill to do, is to be a warm-up comic for a sitcom or game show or talk show. I just love the idea of that gig. So I tell them, look, you know, if you get a sitcom and they're sitting around the table and they go, we got to get somebody to warm this thing up, the two words that better come out of your mouth are Frank and King. So,
yeah. Well, hopefully that happens.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been helping a lot of people, so I'm hoping. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But you know, there was a survey. Somebody did a survey where giving money brings you one level of satisfaction. Giving of your time and doing something selfless. And I don't believe in altruism. I don't think anybody does anything simply for altruistic. You know, this even if the payoff is just feeling good. You know.
Yeah, it is. So how did you become known as the mental health comedian? Because I saw that title and I was like, wow, that's interesting. I've never heard of a comedian, you know, even really tackle mental health.
Well, and there are others out there. My first TED Talk that you saw was my coming out as a depressed and suicidal person. Nobody knew. My family, my friends, my wife didn't know. And I've been a comedian all that time, and I always wanted to make a living and a difference. I could just never figure out how to do the and a difference part. What do I have to teach people? How can I help people in the way of a keynote? You know, what can they walk away with? So I bought a book by Judy Carter called The Message of You. Judy Carter, The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And the idea is, she and a lot of comics buy the book because they want to go from funny speaker to speaker who is funny. And so I went into the book thinking I got nothing to say. I got nothing to teach anybody. But halfway through, it hit me. You know, my grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. Then I came close enough to dying in 2010 by suicide. I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. So I realized as I was preparing for the TEDx, that first one, that you know, at the time, 37,000 people died by suicide in the U.S. every year. Now it's 47,000, one every 11 minutes. But nobody's talking about it. But I figured out, if you just mention the words depression and suicide out loud, people will tell you the most amazing things, people, some of whom I've just met. And so I thought, well, there's a keynote, there's a speaking career. And what people hire me to do is simply, and they say this over and over, starting the conversation on suicide. Because if I start it, then other people will sort of have cover to talk about it and give voice to their feelings and experiences. I have to be, Big and Rich is a singing duo. They've got a song, my personal favorite, called Somebody's Got to Be Unafraid to Lead the Freak Parade. So that's my job. I step up and I go, look, I'm depressed and suicidal. Like, take with the barrel of my gun today. And that gives other people cover. And there, I pick certain industries, occupations that have high rates of suicide. Dentists, veterinarians, construction has the highest rate of suicide. So I market to those industries because they've got a problem and they want to do something about it. And so, the TEDx, my first one, was the beginning of my rebranding from funny speaker to speaker who's funny. And then I needed a brand name. And a friend of mine helped me come up with the mental health comedian because, you know, keywords, mental health, keyword, comedian. So, and oftentimes I'll get hired. You know, they've got choices of who to hire to talk about whatever it is, suicide prevention. But when they see the comedian and then 20 years writing for the Tonight Show, that oftentimes pushes me to the top of the list. So,
wow.
And it's two parts of my personality. I am a comedian, have been forever. And I am depressed, and I have something called chronic suicidality, meaning for me, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. I mean, you saw my TED Talk. Yes. I mentioned it several times. Yeah. My car broke down. I had three thoughts: get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. That's the thought process for somebody with chronic suicidality. And in the TED Talk, I believe I mentioned somewhere along the line that often when I speak, somebody comes up afterwards and they've got that and they didn't know it had a name, and they just thought there was some kind of freak, and the relief is palpable that they're not alone. So I got an email from a guy in Switzerland last week. He said, Frank, I just watched your TED Talk. I'm 42. I've got a lovely 8-year-old daughter, wonderful wife, and I'm miserable. I can't remember the last time I was happy. And he said, and I thought I was all alone. And then I stumbled onto your TED Talk and realized I am not alone.
That is definitely impactful just by you, like you said, speaking out loud.
Yeah, just letting other people know that there are, you know, people out there who are actually willing to get up on video on YouTube and go, I'm crazy as an outhouse rat. How about you?
How early on did you become aware of suicide as being an option that always like popped up when you went through certain things?
High school was fabulous. I loved high school. I tried to stay an extra year, and back then you could do that. But my first wife said, no, you'll be behind. I didn't know at the time that, you know, people don't always finish college in 4 years.
Sure.
Should stay behind, should stay back a year, learn more, you know, learn typing, take another Spanish class. Anyway, I went to college. She went to another college way across the country. Now, I was miserable, but I thought I was just lovesick. I believe I was clinically depressed. Then we got married, and we shouldn't have. I knew that going in, but didn't have the testicular fortitude to back out. And so as we got separated the first time, would have been the spring of 84, I think. Driving down 163 in San Diego about dusk, 5 o'clock is my lowest point in the day. And it was drizzling, and just had the thought, why don't you just kill yourself? Whoa, where did all that come from? That was my first conscious thought of, why don't you just go ahead and kill yourself? Okay. So, and then from that point on, it just became, you know, part of a pattern. If I get stressed or something went wrong, you know, hey, well, you can always kill yourself. So, yeah, at this point, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, there's a good idea. Yeah, that's a good idea. Because it's not a serious thought. You know, it's the young woman I spoke at a college, a young woman came up afterwards. Thank you for your keynote. You're welcome. But it made me weep. Why did it make you weep? She goes, well, you know, the part about your car, get it fixed, buy a new one, or you could just kill yourself. She goes, I've been having those thoughts my entire life. I just thought, I didn't know how to name. I just thought I was some kind of freak. And when I heard you say those words out loud, I realized for the first time in my life, I am not alone. And I wept. That's the ROI for me. That's the therapeutic piece for me. I told a crowd somewhere recently that I realized I'm like George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown by an angel, perhaps one that kept me from pulling the trigger, what these people's lives might be like if I were not there to let them know they're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I've steered them just far enough off the path of suicide that they'll live a normal life.
Exactly.
That's kind of like George Bailey. You know, the angel showed him what Bedford Falls would look like if he had not been born. So
wow. that's definitely a powerful return on investment.
Oh, God. Oh, Lord. Yeah, I mean, I mean, the check, don't get me wrong, Maurice, paycheck's good, too. But that, for me, is terribly therapeutic. And, by the way, it's why I can't kill myself now. That was my second thought. First thought was, I'm George Bailey, and it's a wonderful life. Second thought was, oh, God, oh, no, oh, no, I can't kill myself. You know why? Because I would take all those people with me.
Mm.
And I got that lesson from a gentleman whose father was an alcoholic for a lot of years, got sober, and 20 years in AA, sponsored hundreds of people. Somewhere along the line, somebody said to him, do you think you'll ever drink again? He goes, I'll never drink again. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, because of all the people I sponsored and all the people I'm going to sponsor, if I dived into that bottle again, I would take them with me.
That's a good way to look at it, because somebody is depending on you that keeps you.
Yeah, well, and when people ask me, so let's say somebody says they're depressed, what comes next? Well, ask them if they're having thoughts of suicide. If they're having thoughts of suicide, ask them if they have a plan. If they have a plan, what is your plan? Now, if they're depressed and suicidal and the plan is not particularly specific, you know, if it's very specific, that's dangerous. Get them on the phone with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. But if it's not particularly specific, next question should be, I believe, are you going to kill yourself? Let them give voice to that without, you know, locking them down for 3 days in a mental health facility. And if they say, no, I'm not going to kill myself, then the last question should be, I believe, then tell me why not. Make them give voice to why they're, and I would say, because I'm George Bailey and it's a wonderful life. I cannot kill myself. A friend of mine said, you couldn't live with that? I said, no, I couldn't die with that.
That's great insight, because I know, being in the mental health field myself, it's, you know, these laws that come out. So it's more fear-based why, you know, they would have someone, we would have someone Baker act, you know, instead
yeah.
of, yeah, it's more fear-based if they can't tell us. And, you know, can't assure us they won't harm themselves, you know, then we usually go down that path for sure.
Well, and I think that we would have fewer suicides if people were allowed to give voice to those feelings, because, you know, oftentimes you're in the mental health field. Yeah. You hear it. Yeah, the guy never made any indication, never said anything. You know, I had no idea. Well, you know why he didn't say anything? Didn't want to be Baker acted. You know, I mean, it's Yeah. You know, it's if we could we allow people like me, because, you know, if let's say you and I are in California and you're doing some therapy on me, and I tell you, you know, Frank, you're depressed. Yes. Thoughts of suicide. Oh, yeah. Got a plan. Got a half a dozen plans, just the way I'm wired. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm in front of a judge with you and he's putting me, you know, we're doing an IDO, involuntary detention order, because I said out loud to a therapist in California, you know, I'm having thoughts of suicide. So, like I said, fear-based. So I wouldn't – I met a guy in California, Maurice, at another event. It was a comedy thing, strictly comedy. The USS there's an aircraft carrier there. They got parked there. I can't think which one it is. But anyway, they have like 500 docents. And so I was doing comedy at the docent banquet. And I'm sitting at a table. And, of course, it always comes up as comedy. All you do, and no, I speak on suicide, whatever. So I'm walking to the bathroom. The guy's right beside me. He goes, Frank, I have chronic suicidality as well. I didn't realize it had a name, he said. I just felt like a freak. Okay, that's standard operating procedure. And he was 67 years old. And he said, stop me outside the bathroom. He goes, I want you to know that I've never told anybody what I just told you, not even my therapist.
Powerful.
Because California, 5150, you know, therapists by law might feel compelled to, you know, have him locked down for 3 days.
Yes, certainly.
And that's why he didn't tell him. He was worried the therapist would freak out and lock him down.
Yeah. And this,
but what if he could give voice to those things? What if he could do it without, you know, without that, the threat of that? I mean, if somebody is honest to God, serious, immediate danger to themselves, different.
True.
But just thoughts of suicide, you know.
True. True. That is true. So when did you, I know these things happened in your family, as you mentioned earlier, about suicide, but when did you really get it that, you know, there was mental health issues within your family?
Well, the generation prior to mine, my mother's generation, for all their goodness and wonderfulness, when I was with my mother and found my great aunt, and it's in my first TED Talk, you've seen it, you know it's horrible.
Yes.
I must have compartmentalized it because I had no conscious memory of it. So the family created a myth about how, when she passed away, how serene she was. Hands folded in prayer. Serene. So that was the family line for decades until 2012 or 13 when I was home. And my cousin owns a restaurant in Raleigh. He's 10 years older than I am. So he would be, you know, he would have known about it all as a teenager. So he would have a vivid memory of the incident. And I was describing the hands folded in prayer thing. And he goes, "What? No." And he told me the real story. And you've heard the real story. And it all came flooding back. A wall in my, some brick, wherever I had it compartmentalized, the walls blew away and I was there again. And it all came back. And then I began to take note. My sister's on medicine for anxiety and depression. Pretty much everybody in my family, except that one cousin I just mentioned. The joke I wrote was, more nuts in my family than a 25-pound bag of squirrel food. Everybody has an issue. The good news is, because they're all out about it, the nieces and nephews don't have any problem saying, "Look, I think I'm depressed," or "I think I got a touch of OCD," or whatever it is. There's no stigma in the family about mental health.
Yeah.
So they will be mentally healthier, that generation, my nieces and nephews, than we were, because the adults are out about it.
Well, that is good to hear that, you know, the next generation is getting more of the help they need at an earlier time, I'm assuming.
Yeah, without recrimination, without, you know, they make no bones about it. I've got this issue.
Yeah. So that was, you had all that trauma within you and you just kind of locked it away from 4 years old. And then, you know, having this conversation with your family member, it like brought it all back.
Yeah, it brought it all. Yeah, wherever I had it walled off, it came flooding back.
Wow. Yeah. So trauma, it definitely is stored in our bodies for sure.
Well, and I was just watching The Affair on Showtime, and they were talking about trauma and how there are some studies. I mean, The Affair is fictional, but they were talking about there are some studies that trauma is passed down.
Yes.
From parents to child. They also said that the good news is resilience. You know, if trauma can be passed down, resilience may be able to be passed down as well genetically in the epigenetic world. So it's not just the trauma, but
it's the resilience.
Yeah. It's, you know, and it's depression. The kids nowadays, I think the teen rate of self-reported major depressive disorder and the teen rate of suicide have spiked. They're about 50% higher than they were in 2012.
Yes. There has been a spike for sure. And I know some contributing factors to it. I know. I think also this generation is a little behind the eight ball in developing social skills.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I said to somebody the other day, I feel like a woman when I'm talking to a teenager. No, 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 no. Don't look at my chest. My eyes are up here.
Yeah, the social skills and being able to develop that inner strength, meaning like during high school or in grade school and middle school, you always came into a bully or someone who picked on you and you had to learn how to navigate through words or negotiate and or fight. Sometimes you just had to fight. So you learn how to do that and you develop strength by doing that. But now bullying is illegal, so oftentimes it's kind of taken off the table. So as kids grow up, they've never had to strengthen themselves mentally. So when they go off to college and sometimes they face something really difficult or hard, they don't know what to do and they reverse to harming themselves or doing various other things.
Well, and I think parents have some responsibility. You know, the helicopter parents, you know,
yes,
hovering over them. And now I guess there's something called the snowplow parents, where they plow the road ahead of the kids. So
yeah,
you know, make it easy as possible.
But it's not a good thing. Just like the bird has to develop its strength, the mom can't, you know, fly for them. So
yeah,
yeah. So yeah, no doubt about it. There has to be some struggle in order to build up the strength that you need. So was there, you talked about it earlier, was there a particular event that led you to grabbing the gun? Thankfully you didn't use it, but was there something that happened in particular, or was it just accumulation of things that made you feel that depressed?
Oh no, it was not an accumulation. It was, you know, with the recession and my business dropping off 80%, we lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and I'd been responsible for the finances. So even though I would put some of the blame on Lehman Brothers for crashing the world economy, you know, toxic mortgages, I felt responsible. My wife was suffering greatly, and people who have mental illness, I found, tend to be more empathetic than neuronormal people, and we tend to feel pain, others' pain, more acutely. Matter of fact, my next TED talk is called Depressive Realism. Maybe the glass really is half empty. There's some science that says that depressed people see the world more accurately than people who are neuronormal. There's something called negative cognitive bias, which depressed people have, but there's also something called positive cognitive bias, which means that normal people may be seeing the world more like they wish it were than it actually is. So I tanked our world, and I had a life insurance policy for $1 million. And so, you know, people think, you hear this, suicide's a selfish act, not in the mind oftentimes of the person who's doing it, because there's something called burdensomeness, you know, one of the three legs of the stool of you know, suicidal thoughts, other two, isolation and the capacity. And so I felt like a burden, and I had $1 million life insurance policy, and I knew my wife would miss me and it would break her heart, but she'd be restored financially. So I was going to kill myself for the insurance so she could get $1 million, but I didn't know how long I'd had the policy. And my policy had a 2-year suicide clause, meaning if you killed yourself anytime in the first 2 years, they just returned the premiums. If you killed yourself 2 years in a day, then she gets $1 million. So I called my insurance agents. How long have I had the policy? He didn't realize right away what I was asking, because I really wasn't asking how long I've had the policy. I was asking for permission to kill myself. When he came back on and said 22 months, and then he said, no, don't do it. Because he delivered checks before. People called him, asked him, killed themselves. He delivered checks. When he hung up, he said, because I talked to him later, he told his wife, I think Frank's going to kill himself. So I couldn't kill myself. I couldn't leave my wife brokenhearted and broke. So I had to wait 2 months to kill myself. And ironically, because of my chronic suicidality, because I have the capacity to do it anytime, that allowed me to go on. I figured, well, you know, 2 months in a day, I can do it. So I can survive 2 months, because I know the pain will end at 2 months in a day. So fortunately, when 2 months in a day rolled around, I don't even remember the day. It wasn't like I went, whew. You know, I just kept moving forward at that point, and here we are. But that's what saved me. It was a life insurance policy, had 2 months before it would pay $1 million. So in my mind, it was an unselfish act, because it would, you know, I was worth more dead than alive to my wife. Now, if you ask her, she would have said, no, I don't want the money. I want you. We'll work this out. But, you know,
well, thankful that he was not only doing his job, but he was receptive and to, you know, well, why would he even ask this question? And
he said when we talked, I called him, let him know that the YouTube video had posted and I put his name in it. And he said, you know, Frank, when I realized what you were asking, I didn't know what to say, as many people don't when you think somebody's suicidal. He said, so I said a quick prayer, and I just hoped to God whatever came out of my mouth was the right thing. And I said, because he said, don't do it. I said, Graham, what I've learned in mental health is it's not so much the right thing, is say something. because 8 out of 10 people are ambivalent and they want somebody to say something.
Right. Yeah, they have a conversation. Yeah.
Yep.
True. So who has been the most influential person in your life?
My wife, I think. Well, my mom, of course. We're writing a book. It's done. We just have to, we'll probably publish it in the next couple of months on men's mental health. And then the dedication, I thank my mom for the way I was raised, my darling little sister, and my wife, who Wendy, who has believed in me even when I didn't believe in myself, who's encouraged me to follow my gift. She goes, I think that's where your joy is. That's where the money is. You need to follow your gift. So I've been, you know, because I've told speaker coaching clients, comedy coaching clients, you know, feel like quitting. I go, look, I've quit comedy and speaking 1,000 times. Next morning, the only difference is next morning, you know, I start over 1,001. So.
Yeah, touching story. No, the time is elapsing on us. This, I've definitely enjoyed talking to you. You have so much insight on this area for sure. Is there is there hope for people who have chronic suicidality?
Yeah, I think the hope for me came in an odd way. One, I believe it's just tied up with my abilities. You know, you saw my mental with benefits TEDx about how mentally ill people tend to have a superpower.
Yes.
So I believe I'm mentally disabled and mentally abled, and it's all part of one package. The second thing is, I'm never going to be, I used to say I battle depression, but that's not true, because battle implies I can win. I'm never going to win. I can tie, you know, and stay alive, or I can lose and die by suicide, but I can't beat it. So I try to blend with the energy, kind of an Aikido. There's a martial arts called Aikido, and Aikido is all about blending with the energy of your, you know, whatever's coming at you. So I try to blend with the energy rather than oppose it. Like OCD, I try to use it because it's a powerful force.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wouldn't, if I could take a pill and do and never have another depressed thought and never be suicidal again, but not process things like I do as a comedian, I wouldn't take the pill. I'll take the downside to live with my superpowers.
Gotcha.
So that's helped me, you know, like once I realized there's no beating it, there's no getting well, this is just part of me. And it's you know, it's part and parcel of my talents. And, you know, it's just the way, you know, like anything else, it's, you know, there's good things and bad things about it.
Yeah. When you said, when you gave that illustration about blending with the energy, I thought about Bruce Lee, one of his quotes. He said, everything in life is a force. I can either embrace it, deflect it, but why in the world would I ever oppose it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in Aikido, when somebody's coming at you, let's say they throw a punch, you actually step offline out of the way and you blend, you grab their wrist as it goes by and blend with their energy. Mm-hmm. And then in every Aikido technique, both people at some point are facing the same direction, seeing the world from the same perspective, at which point the attacker can break off the attack if they went, oh, well, that's why you, oh, okay, I see what you see.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things I love about Aikido is that all of a sudden you're both looking at the same thing from the same perspective. And, you know,
yeah.
So, yeah, I just try to blend with, because the depression has a powerful energy. I'm with Bruce Lee. Why oppose it? Why would you ever oppose it?
Yeah. So how can people get in contact with you?
Well, I've put my phone number, my cell number in the show notes.
Okay.
I put it up on the screen every keynote I do, because I tell people, look, if you're suicidal, call the hotline. If you're just, you're mentally ill and just having a really bad day, call a crazy person, because we're less likely to be judgmental. We're just going to listen. And as a friend of mine says, co-sign your BS, just listening. Ooh and ah, oh God, oh Lord, I can't, oh man. And we're not going to do what they call in the mental health business. I imagine you've heard this. We're not going to, I'm not going to should all over you. You should do this and you should do that. And you should try fish oil. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So yeah, just, and people call me, Maurice. They go, I can't believe this is your cell number. Well, how cruel would that be to put it up there and have it be some bogus number?
That's, yeah, that would be bad.
And people call me not only because they're suicidal, but they've got a loved one who is having problems, or their college roommates posting on Facebook and they're frightened by what they're saying. You know, is this dangerous, Frank? So they call for a variety of reasons. Just give somebody, you know, if you have somewhere to reach out. Somebody's gonna pick up the phone and care.
Yeah.
A sliver of hope. That's all I'm really about, is giving somebody just a little bit of hope.
You definitely do that, just through your comedy and your caring nature to help others. I mean, you are definitely doing that. At the end of the show, I'd like to give people the opportunity to, well, give my guests the opportunity to give a piece of advice or something that's called one to grow on. What would be one to grow on you would leave with our audience today?
This is going to sound odd, but hardly anybody knows about this. You hear people say all the time, my antidepressant's not working. I've been on two or three, and it just, you know, I have to go on, then taper off, go on, taper off. There's a DNA cheek swab, you know, Q-tip test for psychotropics. There are four or five companies on the web. They take your DNA and they put it up against all these psychotropics, let's say antidepressants, and they try to find the one or two that, given your DNA, would work best with your metabolism. So it cuts down on the experimentation, the lab rat stuff, you know, the going on and tapering off. And you can get them from those companies on the web, or you can go to Rite Aid. I met a pharmacist on a plane the other day who goes, Frank, look, that's available over the counter at Rite Aid for $40. So, but I can't tell you how many clinicians I've talked to that have never even heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's epigenetics. It's that, you know, they nowadays they can find, I've got a gene for high cholesterol. 1 in 200 people have it. And that's one of the things they can test for with that DNA cheek swab, to see if you got that particular cholesterol gene, or, you know, a gene for diabetes or gene for whatever. Just so happens that they can test your DNA against, you know, this long list of psychotropic medications and find the ones that they believe work best with your metabolism. So that one piece of advice, one tip is, you know, if you're struggling with your medication, get the test. It's a couple $100 from your doctor. It's $40 at Rite Aid.
Great information. And thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, not a lot of wisdom there, but, you know, good practical advice.
Yes, that's helpful.
Yeah, I guess if I had wisdom to give, I would say follow your gift. If you're lucky enough to know what that is, follow your gift.
Okay. Thank you so much, Frank.
Yeah, man. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and Truth Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.